Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
This episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast is being brought to you by Loot Crate. With Loot Crate, you get collectibles, apparels, and more from your favorite pop culture franchises delivered right to your door every month. We're talking about t-shirts in every crate, figures, comics, stuff for your kitchen, a wide range of exclusive items that you can't get anywhere else from fan favorite franchises like Harry Potter, Marvel Comics, Fallout 4, Star Wars, and so much more. You can get it all for less than $20 a month. Loot Crate comes to your door and lets you geek out. And of course, at Major Spoilers, we're all about geeking out. From bad guys doing good things for the wrong reason to good guys with questionable tactics, August is the perfect time to explore the anti-hero. Walk the hero-villain line with this 100% exclusive collection of items from DC Comics, Archer, Dark Horse, and Kill Bill that includes two great collectibles, a wearable, and of course, the monthly t-shirt. There's also a very cool pin you're going to want to get. But you have to act fast. You're going to get these items. You have until 9 o'clock p.m. on the 19th of the month to subscribe. And this is Pacific time, 19th, 9 o'clock Pacific, to subscribe to receive this month's crate. And then if you miss that and the cutoff happens, it's over. You're out. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have a deal for you. Make sure you head to lootcrate.com/spoilers. Enter the code spoilers and save $3 off any new subscription. That's lootcrate.com/spoilers. Enter the code spoilers. Save $3 off any new subscription. Thank you, Loot Crate, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, you got your Q's, we got our A's, so mind your P's and Q's for the MSP PDQ, or we'll all be SOL. Plus, the word Daxum may finally mean something to the general public. Steven's on the Kingsway West, and he just missed his exit. Rodrigo hears the Sun's Dragon song on the Muzak at the Quad Cities Holiday Inn, while my flight's stuck in Wakanda, and I don't know the Wi-Fi password. Plus, your recommended daily allowance of pop culture talk, two scoops of perspective, and just a smidgen of cinnamon. Plus, our kick butt poll of the week. The Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 690 of the Major Spoilers Podcast, 10 away from the big 700, ladies and gentlemen. And we love you so much that we're going to devote a portion of this episode to your questions. That's coming up
issue
later.
700 falls off the top of the Daily Planet building and crushes everything, right?
Yes, that is exactly what happens. But first, let us get to some news. We have three items we can talk about this week. We've got Mon-El is coming to Supergirl, the Ray will be the first gay superhero to lead a series, and Gun Dealer at the Wizard World Chicago Comic Con. Let's spin that wheel of fortune and see where
one of these
land.
Things is not like the other.
No, they are not. Oh, look, it lands on number one. Mon-El is coming to Supergirl. Now, there had been rumors that Mon-El would be in the new season of Supergirl. They even had hired an actor, Chris Wood, to play this unnamed actor, and then at the or this unknown character. And then at the Television Critic Association CW panel this past weekend, they announced that indeed Chris Wood will be playing Mon-El in the upcoming season of Supergirl. Matthew, why is this interesting? Who is Mon-El, first of all?
Well, Mon-El came to Earth and was believed to be Kal-El's big brother, who landed on Earth on a Monday, and thus the name Mon-El. Turns out he's not actually Kryptonian at all, certainly not a member of the El family. He's actually astronaut Largand from the planet Daxum, which was later established to be a Kryptonian colony who spent 1,000 years in the Phantom Zone due to lead poisoning, came out in the year 3005, and became Mon-El of the Legion of Superheroes, arguably the 6th or 7th most popular and notable Legionnaire in history.
I think this is you're really glossing over the history of Mon-El, which is good. We can save that for another podcast. But a couple of things. Number one, the reason why Superman thought he was his big brother was because when he crashed, Superman rifled through his pockets and found a map written in Kryptonian.
In Kryptonian.
And so therefore he believed that his father, Jor-El, must have sent Mon-El to him, and he got lost along the way. Then as far as the lead poisoning goes, oh man, Superman really doesn't like having a big brother around, and poisons him with a lead box. In which case, Largan realizes...
It was the 60s, actually. It was the 50s.
It was 50s, 1951. Yeah, this is Superboy number 89, or 61, sorry, in which this issue took place. The thing that I find fascinating is that we've seen a Legion flight ring in the series of The Flash.
Yes.
We have seen time travel in Flash and...
Legends.
And now we have Mon-El... I know CW has said, Ashley, CW has said, no, we're kind of done with superhero shows at the moment, but I really think we're getting prepped for a Legion of Superheroes TV series, which would be the CW-est of all CW shows.
That'd be pretty cool. I could get behind that.
Are you a Legion of Superhero fans?
I have read exactly one Legion of Superheroes story, Legion Lost. That's dope. And I really dig the cartoon. We're rewatching it right now.
Oh, cool.
I love the cartoon.
Yeah,
the cartoon is great.
I think puts Matter Eater Lad and Bouncing Boy in the spotlight where they belong. DC, if you're listening, stop being ashamed of your heroes.
Plus, I like their weird, like, giant, like, elbows and hands and feet.
Oh, yeah, in that animated show, yeah.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Ashley? You were going to say butt?
I was gonna say, I think it's a great way to do kind of what they are doing on Legends, where you are taking characters that do have an established history and have a really interesting hook, but maybe are not so mired in continuity as some other characters, so that you can really celebrate them and do something truly unique in the TV universe with them.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, the end of season one of Supergirl had a rocket that looked very much like a Kryptonian rocket crash into Earth, and Supergirl rips off the cover, and we don't get to see what's inside, and so everyone's like, oh, it's gonna be Streaky the Cat. What are the chances that this is actually Mon-El in that ship?
I think that's a pretty decent chance that that is in fact the case.
5-1.
And the second follow-up question, Rodrigo, is Mon-El has one issue appearance in Superboy of 89. Are we going to see a one or two episode appearance of Mon-El on Supergirl before she shuns him off to the Phantom Zone?
I don't know. Maybe. I think, we've seen... adaptations in TV and movies try to do like a very faithful adaptation of like a particular segment of a superhero's life in the comics. And we've also seen them basically say, here's a guy with the same name and nothing else.
Hello. What is going on?
Hmm.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm running. You just dove off, dropped off again right where you were talking about the name.
Okay, so it sounds like Matthew and Ashley can still hear me.
Yes.
Yeah, that's weird.
It is just, of course, that doesn't matter because matters is like whether I'm being recorded or not. I can try and restart something here.
It's all of you. So it's something else. It's stupid Skype.
Okay.
I think it's a stupid Skype thing. So I guess my question then, Matthew, is now we can't really trust IMDb because they're going to list this character for every single episode of the series. But what if he is listed as every single episode of the series? And now that the Kryptonians are gone, Mon-El becomes the big villain for this season.
Possible. I think that with the addition of Superman and the already extant Martian Manhunter, it's just another person in the mix who has superpowers that she can interact with as a peer or a mentor or a romantic figure. I think that whatever they do at some point during the season, we're going to see the dramatic, oh my God, we have to shunt you into the zone.
Right.
You know, maybe the season finale. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if you have somebody who's around for several episodes and then slowly feeling weird or strange things are happening, and then, oh no, he's all going to die, and having him, you know, turn out to be the villain, that's pretty much the arc for a certain character on another WB show who shall remain nameless for this last season. So could they do it again? Sure. Should they make Mon-El a villain? No. But that's just me. I think Mon-El's got a great costume. He's got a great thing going for him. And frankly, he's one of my fave raves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are they still doing that thing where Supergirl is working with that government agency?
Well, we don't know yet because everything's being shifted over to the CW for this season. You know, so
the last we saw, she was.
Right. Yeah. So interesting.
David Harewood has shared the set. The actor who plays Martian Manhunter.
Right.
So we could maybe potentially see a thing where Mon-El is on the run from them and Supergirl's trying to help him, basically making him this like weirdly antagonistic character that is still technically a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so we do also know that we have Martian Manhunter in this show. Mm-hmm. We've got Superman in this show. We're going to get Miss Martian in this season. Mm-hmm. And we're getting Mon-El. Are we getting too many heroes, Ashley, that Supergirl, especially names like Superman and I would imagine for younger viewers, Miss Martian would, and maybe even Mon-El, might be pushing the lead off to the side? It just kind of feels like, hey, why don't we just shove as many people in here? And oh, yeah, it's still called Supergirl, but good luck.
I mean, I don't know why we're surprised that we're doing that. Even when Superman wasn't on screen, she was shunted aside to be saved by him on no less than three occasions. I am troubled by it's a huge act of desperation is what it is. It's expletive. We need the ratings bump. We better put Superman and some other cool guy and who's a girl? Miss Martian on there.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of white Kryptonian types. And yes, the actress who's playing Miss Martian is a very lovely, not Caucasian lady, but I was really excited when they first announced Mon-El because I always think that Mon-El is actually Black Superman. And then I got real disappointed when I was like, oh, it's just the Daxamite.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know. I remain not excited to see Superman on Supergirl. And frankly, I'm not excited by any of this casting news. Now, if it's an amazing story, I will mea culpa and I will definitely come around on it as I have on things in the past. But yeah, to me, even though you know that the show is in desperate times with desperate measures, I just think it's an awful lot when you already have like five main characters.
Yeah. I really
it's
think
a
if they're
Berlanti show though.
Well, but I mean, think if they're smart, I think Mon-El really, if they're going to do that Mon-El storyline, they keep him in for two episodes, they shunt him off to the Phantom Zone, and then, you know, Kara's just like, oh, I lost my cousin, and Superman can say, well, he's not really your cousin, and I'm sorry, I poisoned him and took your best friend away.
She already has two best friends. She doesn't need another best friend. She had three love interests last season, and it was terrible.
And I can see, with the reveal of Martian Manhunter and his plight as being a hunted alien on Earth and everything that's gone on with him, he needs a story arc. And so that's where we're going to get the Miss Martian bit coming in. That'll introduce another female hero. But as we know from everything we've read about Miss Martian, especially on the Young Justice series, she's a white Martian and not such a good Martian to the green Martians of John Jones's group.
She's a good white Martian, just like John's big brother is the bad green Martian.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing about Berlanti shows is they stuff in all the characters they can. You know, the fly. You have to fit 15 people in the background of a Star Labs shoot.
And I mean, legit, everybody knows that he's Barry Allen. Like, it's ridiculous.
Right. Well, it is, and, like, I mean, go ahead.
Supergirl is a show that has not yet stuffed to the gills with characters. I mean, this mess. But, you know, we are at the point where I think that Berlanti's production writing people, whoever's behind this, if it's him himself, if it's like a team of people, they're more comfortable having a big ensemble cast so they can shuttle people in and out. And, you know, you can do that thing where it's like, I'm going to go take a nap for two episodes.
Well, yeah. It costs less money too, because even your actors who are on a salary pay and are making more, if they're in less episodes, they're just shunting off less money. Guest stars are cheaper for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Supergirl is set to air October, 20th, is the date on that. That's its season premiere on the CW. The head of programming has said they expect, and this is the interesting thing, they expect Supergirl to have better ratings than any of the other superhero shows on the network. They expect it to have the highest ratings, which is a big expectation for the show. I don't know if they're going to bring in the 7 million viewers or whatever.
It did last round. It had higher ratings than Flash.
Right.
Just not high enough for a network.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Will the 7 million plus people who watch it on CBS come over to the CW, where the Flash, I think it most had 4 million viewers in season two. So I'm hoping that it does translate, and that'll mean that a lot more people will check out a lot of these other shows. I don't know. I think that's a lot of pressure they're putting on Supergirl, a show that they've already cut the budget on, that not all of the actors are returning as regular full-time roles, including Calista Flockhart is not coming back full-time in the next season. So I don't know. I'm hoping that it'll still stand up. It looks like maybe it's the 17th. October 17th is when we see Supergirl debut. We will all be watching it, and we will all be talking about it here on Major Spoilers. Listeners, you can head over to MajorSpoilers.com. You can check out these stories and a whole lot more. And if you're one of our Patreon members at Patreon.com/MajorSpoilers, you can catch a little bonus episode where we talk about this weird story about a potential gun dealer at the Wizard World Chicago Comic-Con coming up in a couple of weeks. Find that more at patreon.com/majorspoilers. You can contribute as little or as much as you want, but every bit that you do contribute comes back to Major Spoilers and allows us to do shows like this week after week. So many shows, something like 7 shows a week when everything is said and done, which is amazing and somewhat scary, if you ask me.
Yeah, but for real.
I'm right in the middle of editing something. It's like a 3-hour video episode for Munchkin Land, and it's not going to be done for like 4 more days. And it could be done sooner, but I'd need to hire an assistant to come in and do that. But we can only do that with patron support, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Everyone, let us get to some reviews.
Reviews.
Matthew, let us start with you with Black Panther number 5, which I believe came out last week.
It did. It came out on, Wednesday. When do comics come out these days?
Wednesday.
What are the kids today like? Okay. Written by, I believe it's Ta-Nehisi Coates.
No, the kids are wrong. Not me.
The kids are wrong. Yeah, that's right. The children are wrong. Drawn by, say it with me, Chris Sprouse. Sorry, I love me some Chris Sprouse. Always love me some Chris Sprouse. Going back to the days of Legionnaires, back when the story sucked, but boy, the art was awesome. Black Panther is, of course, the king of the African nation of Wakanda. And in recent issues, an insurgent group called the People have been trying to get all of the people to overthrow the Black Panther. They're basically sowing dissent amongst the people of Wakanda with the help of Ezekiel Stane, who is the son of Obadiah Stane, played by Jeff Bridges in the Iron Man movie. So, you know, he's a jerk. And now T'Challa, the Black Panther, has also lost his sister Shuri, who was the Black Panther briefly herself, is dead.
Oh, no.
Sort of.
No.
Yes, she's sort of dead. She's in a sort of a quasi land of the undead living where she's hanging out their deceased mother. This is a really fascinating issue. I've read a lot of Black Panther, and the first Black Panther stories I read were literally insane. They involved time-traveling frogs. They were drawn by Jack Kirby. Check them out. And the Black Panther's been a lot of places, but this is the first time since, I don't know, maybe Fantastic Four in the early 70s, that he feels like a realistic world leader. And that's a good thing, and that's also a bad thing. In this issue, he hangs out with, and I thought this guy was dead, so I'm thrilled, Manifold, who was an Avenger for a while. Manifold is the guy who can teleport pretty much anywhere in the known universe. He's awesome. I think his uncle is Gateway of the X-Men. And they have to go and teleport around and figure out some stuff and fight some bad guys. Turns out that the bad guys are implanting actual Wakandan citizens with bombs tied to their heartbeat.
That's horrible.
So they're literal human bombs. It is horrible. And then the Black Panther meets with a group of other heads of state, but only bad states like Genosha and Simkaria and what's that place? Madripoor, where Wolverine used to hang out and beat people up. And all of the bad world leaders tell him, if you're going to rule, you got to rule by fear. You got to torture your people. You got to beat them up. You got to make sure that they don't know which way the pain is coming from. And then, and only then, can you lead. And Black Panther says, you guys suck, which is important because that part in the video transcript is released to the people of Wakanda, who are already upset, who now see their leader meeting with the leaders of all the evil nations, except for Latveria, by the way. Dr. Doom's a good guy right now. And now they're really mad. And Black Panther has a couple of things going on, and the end of the issue has a moment that is really, really impressive just as character work. I really love Sprouse's art. I like what they've done with the technology of Wakanda. I'm less than thrilled with the fact that Marvel insists that for centuries Wakanda has never been attacked, never been invaded, never been this, never been that, and in the last 5 years it's happened like a dozen times. Mm-hmm. But that is more of a thematic problem at Marvel and really with a lot of major storytellers, which is sometimes people say this has never happened, this will make for a great story. Well, no, sometimes things don't happen for a reason. Sometimes Uncle Ben doesn't come back for a reason. And of course, there's the subplot with Shuri in the Land of the Dead, where she is learning a long and complex mission that also tells us some of the missing backstory of Wakanda and T'Challa's history and his forefathers, which is really fascinating. And it's weird to see all this interplay being done in 22 issues of a regular monthly comic. It feels like there's a lot of complexity here, even, you know, for a modern Marvel comic where a Bendis conversation can be 3 issues long. You have a lot of complexity, a lot of really fascinating stuff. This is a really strong issue. Plus Chris Sprouse! Sorry, I don't get much Sprouse these days. 4 slices of meatloaf for Black Panther number 5. I'm definitely in for the long haul on this. I want to see what's going on. Of course, there's also his former bodyguards who are running around doing something, hopefully something good and not something evil. And Zeke Stane, of course, gets to shoot people because he has repulsors built into his neck, which is gross.
All right. Cool. Thank you, Matthew. And Rodrigo, let's check out with what you have this week. What is Sun Dragon's Song?
Sun Dragon's Song is, an all ages book. That's what I believe they're saying. It is, this is issue 1 of 4, and it is the story, it is by Joyce Chang, I believe, and Kim Miranda, and it is the story of a young boy who wants to be a sun dragon rider, and dragons are just around, and these are like Asian-type dragons. They don't have wings, they're just kind of like long, snaky types.
Cool.
Yep. And we find out that his parents are dragon riders, and we just kind of see this young person go through some hardship. He's got some kids that pick on him, and trying very hard. He has a disability of some kind. He has to walk around with a crutch. So... is like, will I ever become a dragon rider kind of thing? And then he gets a fateful letter from the Sun Dragon Academy as to whether he will be able to do it or not. This is really cute. It's a cute comic. It is kind of like giving you a lot of insight into our main character here. It would have been easy to start it at the first day of Dragon Rider Academy, if that's where they're going, you know, but mostly you get this like kind of, there's like the dragons are in the background. They're like out doing stuff, but it is mostly about like kind of day-to-day life for this character. It's an interesting way to go about it. You know, they're not leading with like the craziest possible thing. It's kind of the sort of storytelling that you hope if you're going to have an ongoing series. The art is cool. It has kind of this feel at times. The colors are very flat. It doesn't seem to be a problem. Like, it doesn't seem to be like they were trying to not make them flat and they just came out that way. The look of the piece. It's interesting. It has this kind of like simultaneous, very digital feel and very like kind of like pen feel to it as well. Character design is good. I like the dragons. The dragons are like a lot cuter than are depicted sometimes. They look kind of like their heads look kind of like big goat dog kind of things. It's cute. Altogether, I was pretty happy with it. I would give it 3.5 slices of meatloaf. It's something that if you have a young reader, they'd probably be really into.
Very cool.
Especially, if they're into that sort of I am secretly magical type story, which I think every child is into, actually, now that I think of it.
Yeah, I think everybody is, including
a lot of old guys are.
Including our own Ashley. Magical Ashley, yes. What have you got for Supergirl Rebirth?
We're probably not going to talk enough about Supergirl on the show, so let me just read this. It comes out tomorrow, unless you're listening to this in the future. Hello, future people. So, Supergirl Rebirth has this giant hurdle going into Rebirth, in that there's already a really good Supergirl comic currently being published by DC Comics. That ties directly into the television show. It's called Adventures of Supergirl. It comes out weekly, half issue digitally, and then they print it about a month later. You can go and pick it up and then buy the trade whenever their trade print schedule goes. So you have a good story there. You have the likeness of the person that you like from the TV and a direct tie-in to the story from the TV, which you know and love because nobody else who's not watching Supergirl reads Supergirl comics. Supergirl Rebirth number one wants to be all those things without being a direct tie-in. And for me, that's where it fails on a lot of fronts. Supergirl works for the DEO, but the DEO is run by, what's her name? Chase. She was a detective.
Cameron Chase,
who's a great character and a great character to include and to put in that position. But she's no shape-shifting Martian. And Supergirl is a blonde lady. Cameron Chase is a blonde lady. Instead of her sister being Eliza and Jeremiah, who are much younger, hunkier versions of their TV selves, Eliza is another white, blonde lady. So you have basically three incarnations of characters that you're familiar with from the TV show, but they're sort of like less interesting versions than you see on TV. And three of them are white blonde girls who, despite the fact that Emanuela Lupicino draws beautiful women, they all look like the same beautiful women. And in my brain, I want to call her Lupita Nyong'o, even though that is not remotely the same person. So this issue is a lot of exposition. And if you've been watching Supergirl or reading Supergirl, you kind of know what's going on. I'm Kara. I'm from Krypton. I crashed on Earth. I kind of get angry. I have these adopted parents. I work for the DEO, except now I'm 16, even though I look like I'm 25 and I'm in high school. And for me, this is basically a mishmash of everything that I already know about Supergirl. And while Devil's Advocate, that is what many of the Rebirth specials before the series launches, that's what many of them are. It's basically a reintroduction to this character. For me, there's nothing unique and different enough about this that makes it in any way exciting. Now, I'm really looking forward to the next issue when the story starts, because there's really no story in this issue. It's a lot of people talking, and then Kara fights a Kryptonian werewolf.
Awesome.
Spoiler alert. But yeah, I haven't read all the Rebirth specials, but this is the one so far that I am the most disappointed in. It looks really beautiful. You won't be able to tell the ladies apart. The action scenes are good, even if they come out of left field. So for the fact that I'm just really happy that we have a Supergirl series, I'm going to give it 2.5 stars because it doesn't, or slices of meatloaf, because it doesn't get anything like horrifically wrong. It just doesn't get anything incredibly right, like so many of the Rebirth specials have so far.
I want to come back to Rebirth in a little bit in our Q&A session, because someone asked about that. But there seems to be a trend that I've noticed with the Rebirth comics that that we can get into in a little bit. So let's, what do they say, put a pin in it and we'll come
table
back.
Table that.
Yeah. Coming out, I don't know if it's this week or next week.
Stick a pin in it, we'll come back later.
Yeah. I don't know if it comes out this week or next week, because I saw Greg Pak say it comes out next week, but I could have swore Dark Horse told me it came out this week. It's Kingsway West, #1, from Greg Pak and Mirko Kolak. It is an alternate history tale, which is the thing that you have to kind of figure out right up front. It takes place in a time period just before the gold rush. And in this world, there is something called red gold that everyone is after. Apparently it has quote unquote magical properties. This is a world where dragons fly around, little baby dragons fly around that you can use as kind of a hunting animal. There's all sorts of weird beasts that also roam the country. Now this red gold was found in what we would know today as California. And so California is settled by the Chinese. It is also being fought over with the Mexicans. And so at some point in this history of this story, the Mexican Mexico and the Chinese people that have taken over the western part of the United States have come to a tentative truce that they're not going to battle over the land anymore, providing that no more red gold is found. Of course, everybody wants to find red gold because it has all these weird, crazy properties. And we are introduced to this character called Kingsway West, who is Chinese, who was one of the freelanders. And these are people that just live, that are not part of the Queen's army and not part of the Mexican army. They're just people that are trying to pioneers, live in this land. Unfortunately, because of his time with the Freelanders and their movement, he's been branded a traitor. So the Chinese army is after him constantly, trying to kill him. And that's kind of where this book opens up. He does get shot after taking a bunch of guys out, and he is discovered by a Mexican woman who's also a Freelander, who is also someone who is kind of being persecuted by her country and her countrymen. There's also this huge thing about if you get involved with someone of the other race, then you are going to be in big, big trouble. And these two fall in love, and we get a jump forward a few years when Kingsway's wife is murdered, and he's going to go after the people that took her down because a new vein of red gold has been discovered, and everybody is going to be flooding into this territory to take it over. Now, the interesting thing in this alternate history is that apparently Indian nations continue to thrive, and they have their own metropolises and cities that have been growing. But with this discovery of a new vein of red gold, the United States of New York have appeared on the scene, and they're ready to also track down Kingsway, because he may know the location of this vein of red gold. And that's kind of where the first issue ends. So from a magical reimagining of United States history, it's kind of interesting, but there's so much to grasp in the opening issue and so much to try to wrestle with as far as who's fighting who, what group is what, that it kind of gets confusing. And it's not helped that everybody looks like your normal average person in the comic. There's not enough distinct differences to know that this white general is supposed to be white as opposed to this other person who's supposed to look Asian. And it really gets mixed up in that way, because everybody looks like an average tan person. And it doesn't look, there's really hard distinctions between the different groups of people, which makes it hard because the lead character, after his wife is killed, meets up with a bounty hunter from, I want to say she's from the Queen's, the Chinese Queen's army, or maybe she's just a bounty hunter or whatever. She looks just like the dude's wife. So again, it gets very convoluted as far as the as some of the character depictions go. The art, though, is very pretty, and it is very nice. And the story, I think, is an interesting one. I just kind of want to see this. I want to see where this goes, and I'm hoping it's just not a revenge-driven story. It could very well be, but it's interesting right now. I really enjoyed the story, even though it's a lot to grasp a hold of. I did have to read it a couple times to make sure that I knew who everyone was representing. From there, I think it's going to be very interesting. I liked it. And I'm giving it 4 slices of meatloaf out of 5. It's Kingsway West. It's either out this week or next week from Dark Horse Comics. And you might want to pick it up and check it out. So there you go. You can find more reviews, listeners, over at majorspoilers.com. That's the place to go to. We want to see a bunch of you over there. We want to see a bunch of you interacting in the comments section. Some really good comments over the last couple of weeks. And I should also tell you that we have this thing called the Poll of the Week over there at majorspoilers.com.
Can I do the...
Well, providing the internet is being happy with us, then yes, you may. But the internet is not being happy with us, so let us move on to a suggestion that was sent in by Spoilerite James, who wants us to engage in a thought experiment this week. Imagine if Netflix were to take over the Doctor Who franchise, and they want an American actor to play the title role.
That's a horrible idea.
I know, right, first of all. The network has narrowed... It's a doctor selection down to 3, but they want the audience to pick the best of the 3. And so which actor would you want to see play the doctor? Bruce Campbell, Patrick Dempsey, or Jonathan Frakes? Ashley?
Like literally none.
I know, right?
I appreciate the thought experiment. I will point out that you picked a bunch of white middle-aged dudes. Yeah. So I guess that's typical of a network's choice. I mean, Jonathan Frakes is the only one on there who I think can act.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I will, with great reticence, pick him, but he's not a doctor. He's Riker, man.
Yeah. Matthew, what about you?
I'm with Ashley on this. There's a fundamental issue with the question being asked. However, I think we can take it on face value of these 3. Which actor would you want to play the doctor? I would never want an American to play the doctor. And frankly, Patrick Dempsey's not terrible. I've seen him in things. My wife loves Grey's Anatomy. He can almost act. Jonathan Frakes is 65, which is a little bit up there for a doctor, I feel. It's kind of an action runny role in many situations. So I had to go with Bruce simply because I feel like if you're going to do something this spectacularly dumb, something that misses the point, and please do not think that I'm making fun of whomever sent the question.
No, absolutely not.
I love this question. I feel like theoretical people making this decision are doing something dumb. If you're going to be dumb, sometimes you got to really lean into the skid.
Right.
And since Bruce Campbell has basically been playing Bruce Campbell since at least 1997. We'll say from Xena forward, Bruce Campbell, I think, is pretty much playing Bruce Campbell. Then just throw your chips in. Put it all in. You're going to go caution to the wind. Stick him in the TARDIS. Give him a standard old school British companion to go, oh, my stars, Doctor, what are you doing?
Nah, they'll give him a girl from Texas or Arkansas or something.
Yeah, but it should be somebody really English because she can be like, how dare you do that? Ah, shut your pie hole, sister. We got to get out of here. You can totally make that not, I guess, work is probably the wrong word, but at the very least you can make it sing. And what it really comes down to for me is a question of, is it of a piece? If you look at the 13 actors, 15, 16, if you look at the 27 actors who have played a doctor, they all have 2 things in common. One, they're all British, except for the ones that are Scottish and that one who was Welsh. So really, they're all from somewhere in the United Kingdom and or Europe. And 2, sometimes when they have to, they'll chew the scenery all to death. And I feel like that's what Campbell is really going to stick out amongst these.
Okay, Rodrigo, what about you?
I think the real quiet genius of this question is that really it asks you what kind of doctor do you like in like this with like this very complex premise. Mm-hmm. Because all three of these, like that's what's really interesting. And I looked at these choices a lot. It's like, do you want a handsome young doctor? Mm-hmm. Do you want a more experienced older doctor? Or do you want a doctor that's going to wear a funny hat and say funny things all the time? Right. And we've had all three of those. We've, you know, you can probably, as I was saying, that you probably pictured a specific doctor. And also these guys, I think each would fit into each of those categories. For me, yeah. I would probably go with, and this was difficult. It was a big, a difficult choice between Frakes and Campbell. And I think it's partially because I would want some sci-fi gravitas, but also fundamentally, I do want a doctor that says funny things and is quippy and stuff. And I think Campbell would probably handle that better because Frakes would be just way too cool about it.
Yeah.
It's like whenever
Frakes would be like a combination of 10 and 4 to me.
Yeah. Whenever, you know, whenever you see Frakes and stuff, he's just like, just so confident and cool in every way. And you want the doctor to be falsely confident a lot of the time. And I think that's something that Bruce Campbell would bring to this very complex hypothetical role.
When this email first came in and it said, you know, pick an American actor to play, I was like, oh, I'd like to see, what's his name? Danny Pudi from Community. Is it Pudi or Danny? Ooh. I think
Pudi.
Pudi. I think an Indian actor. I mean, he's Indian, American, Polish. I think it'd be interesting to see that take on the doctor. And he's just funny enough to be able to do it. But like you guys said,
plus he plays Inspector Spacetime.
Right,
exactly.
Exactly. But because we're limited to these three, I had to go with Bruce Campbell because I think when it comes to being, you know, in a serious moment, he can be serious, but he can also out of the side of his mouth be cocky and arrogant and funny. And if you need to add some slapstick in there, you know, he knows how to do that as well. So I went with Bruce Campbell.
He can slap a stick with the best of them.
Yes, he can. Matthew, how has everyone else voted? Most of the people in the comments were like, oh, man, how come Nathan Fillion isn't on this list?
Well, because Nathan Fillion can't be in everything.
Yes, he can.
And also, Nathan Fillion is not a doctor. Nathan Fillion is a square-jawed stand-up. Nathan Fillion, you know who he could be? He could be Captain Kirk. Nathan Fillion could be...
I mean, maybe 25 years ago.
An older Captain America. I'm not saying right now. I mean, Jonathan Frakes is I think, too old for the role of Doctor Who. The current
really? Because
doctor
we've
like
had
56.
Like 60-year-old doctors.
Name one.
I don't know. Wasn't the first one like 100,000 years old?
55. Bill Hartnell was 55. People were older in the 60s than they are.
I know, because he looks like he's about to blow over. And I think
he does.
Isn't he?
He's
the same age
as the current doctor.
Yeah, but
Peter Capaldi.
But I believe Capaldi when he runs around that he won't blow over.
He's right, because he's much younger at 55 than you would be at 55 in the 60s.
Yeah,
55 in the 60s is like 70 now.
Orange is the new 40.
Right. And Peter Capaldi in the 1960s is the equivalent of a 35-year-old man, which means that Matt Smith is actually an eighth grader. But nonetheless, right now, the voters are overwhelmingly 54% picking Bruce Campbell because look at the chin, man. How can you argue with that chin? 32% leaning towards Commander Riker, which would mean that all the chairs on the TARDIS would be backwards, which would be hysterical. And only 14% giving a little love to McDreamy. The man can act. I mean, don't you remember that? What was that movie where he was that kid and he would go around and he turned out he was a gigolo?
13 again?
He drove her in. No, I think it was called The Woo Woo Kid or no. Heartbreak. The Heartbreak.
That sounds
kid.
Terrible.
You are so negative. It was
I'm a millennial.
Terrible.
It's my gig.
Well, I'm Generation X, which means that I love things ironically.
Yeah, it means that...
Have you seen
that,
Stranger Things yet?
Oh, yes, that movie is so good. Or that show is so good.
Generation Xers are just internally negative.
Right. Wait, the thing is, we hate everything, but we hate it all with an equal passion. We're like, oh, this thing that's probably going to suck is great. If you want to see that in action, just read anything I've ever read about the written or spoken about the Legion of Superheroes. But anyway, Bruce Campbell.
54%. There you go. Bruce Campbell. 54. Yes, Ashley, I have watched Stranger Things, and it is fantastic. It's a great Netflix series. On Finally Friday last week, we had kind of a little spoiler-filled discussion of Stranger Things. So if you want to talk about that or you want to listen to that, head over to majorspoilers.com and look that up. The great Nate O., who's one of our great supporters, our number one supporter, he actually joined me for like 20, 30 minutes, and we talked about Stranger Things. We didn't even get to cover everything that I wanted to cover in the discussion, but man, that show is so good on so many levels. And I did have a kind of an observation of why I think it works compared to why I think shows like The 12 Monkeys or Fargo or some of these retellings of other shows maybe don't hit it for me. So you might want to go check that out. It's Finally Friday. We do it every Friday. It's a live show that we do on YouTube. And you can, of course, check it out at majorspoilers.com.
I'm so afraid of that show.
Why? I saw. Oh, go ahead.
People talk to me about it the same way they talk to me about a book called Ready Player One, which everyone told me, yeah, this is the most Matthew thing ever. And It probably is.
Ready Player One probably is, but it's probably more like the most Rodrigo thing ever because it focuses more.
Ready Player One.
It focuses more on the video game aspect of stuff as opposed to the overall pop culturiness of the 80s. What Stranger Things does is it takes some of the best things about the 80s and the movies that we watched in the late 70s and early 80s and really pays an homage to them without necessarily just ripping them off. And just, you know, in Ready Player One, they're basically throwing out 80s and 70s, you know, pop culture quotes left and right. And everyone's supposed to know this and get the big laugh out of it. Stranger Things doesn't do that. It just says, hey, remember the cool parts about these movies and things you remember from the 80s? Here they are without us. Without
you remember
us.
The 80s?
Yeah, but it's not doing it in a way that's, you know, like nudge, nudge, you know what I mean, know what I mean kind of stuff, right? And so the reason why I think Stranger Things really works is because it's taking themes and ideas that you remember and injecting them into the story as opposed to just ripping things off blatantly. Now, yes, you can watch it, and I think the second or third episode you're watching it, and you're like, oh, this is E.T. meets Firestarter. Well, yeah, that's E.T. meets Firestarter without saying, okay, here's the shot of young Drew Barrymore starting a man's arm on fire. It's not like that. It's like, here are the things that you remember that you liked about it shoved into this story, into eight episodes. It's not bad, Matthew. I liked it a lot. Ashley, did you like it?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, man, you really need to see it.
I have, as someone who did not live through any of it, I have zero love or nostalgia for the 80s. And I kind of have the Matthew belief that if everyone tells me it's amazing, I don't know if I want to watch it.
The problem was the first two episodes that I watched, I was really like,
yeah,
oh, this is not good. And then I realized what they were doing. And I was like, OK, let me just run with it and let's get involved with the characters and the story. And there are some great characters and some great actors in this piece. Winona Ryder plays a
Fox mom.
She plays a great mom in this piece. Then you've got the kid that plays Toothless is wonderful. The girl that plays Eleven is fantastic. I mean, it's just some really good acting in this piece. And it's not gore porn horror that we see so much today in horror. It is classic 80s horror where there's frightening things, but it's not to the extreme. And that's why I liked it as a horror film. So everybody should go check it out. We are having some audio problems with the internet today, but that doesn't mean that you can't still hear us in crisp, clear mono by using a pair of Tweaked Audio headphones from tweakedaudio.com. They come in a lot of different styles, a lot of different colors. My suggestions, I took a picture the other day while I was at soccer practice, and someone said, are those Tweaked Audio headphones that you're wearing? Yes, it is. The ones that I have always come with the microphone built in, so that in case someone does call and needs to talk to you, or if you need to fire off a quick message to somebody, or if you need to record something, you can do that with that optional microphone. So great. So many different styles, so many different designs. You're going to find one that you like. And best of all, when you go to tweakedaudio.com and use the checkout code MAJOR, M-A-J-O-R, you're going to get 33% off the price. Thank you, Tweaked Audio, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Everybody still here? Good.
I'm here.
All right. Question. Let's go back to that Rebirth thing. One of our listeners wrote in and says, how do you think Rebirth is going?
think the sales figures say it all.
Oh, yeah. The sales figures are great. I mean, for the first time in since I can't remember, probably when the new 52 launched, DC has the top sales for the month of July.
And the majority market share as well.
And the majority market share. I mean, they took in the top 10, they had 8 of the top 10 books as far as the market share goes. And, of course, Marvel had the other two. Dark Horse is nowhere to be found on that list. I think it made it in number 18, but they've really dropped a lot in the last couple of years. Image Comics moves up there, but from the sales standpoint, Rebirth has been really good, and I think it is bringing back some interest in these characters that people like. The one thing that I'll say about the specific Rebirth issues is it feels like a clip show episode. Where it's like,
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, where it's like, hey, remember all these things that have been going on? And then you get a flashback to everything that's happened in the new 52 to get you caught up to this point. And if you are kind of caught up with everything that's going on in the new 52, I'm not sure that the specific Rebirth issues are worth picking up, but the number one issues definitely are worth picking up.
Yeah. And I think that they've made course corrections that I feel were necessary. And I read and enjoyed a Green Arrow story for the first time since 2011. I generally liked Green Arrow when I was younger, and I haven't been able to stand Green Arrow. Oh, the Rebirth Green Arrow was great. I feel like the Rebirth Wonder Woman made a lot of really good moves. Rebirth Flash was kind of, I do agree with you on the clip show part of it, but I think that that's also by design because they're expecting that this is bringing back lapsed readers.
Right.
And honestly, if we look at those clip shows, some of the things that are happening in these clip shows actually didn't happen in the continuity. There yeah. have been changes, and we're now going, oh, yep, this always happened like this, and this is the way it's always used to have. Marvel formula of, we have always been at war with Oceana, which I think is really brilliant for DC. I think it's working for them creatively as well as just in terms of monetarily.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, if you've been following New 52, probably the Rebirth number one issues are not necessary. But if you are a new reader, I think definitely jump on board. Right, Ashley?
Yeah, for sure. There are some Rebirth issues that I think, because they are doing a lot of course correcting, they're quite good. Matthew mentioned Green Arrow Rebirth, basically. And I like the Jeff Lemire stuff, but it basically is like, remember the cool stuff about that and the cool stuff about the guy with the beard and the cool stuff about the TV guy? Yeah, we're doing all that. And he kisses Black Canary. Yeah. Sweet. So like, that's really great. I think the Titans, specifically Titans, because Teen Titans, I think, drops next week. The Titans one is really great because they have to deal with reestablishing the team post-Titans Hunt and the Wally West of it all. So, like, that's a really great one. And then I think Superman Rebirth is really great because Jonathan Kent and having Superman be married to Lois is, like, the greatest thing that's happened to Superman in ever, maybe. So I feel like
he was married to her for like 20 years. 20 years.
I know, but now he's allowed to be again. Yeah. But I feel like the ones that are introducing like newer concepts and newer characters, like the ones that have the most kind of back matter to just be like, forget all of this ever happened behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. Those are the strongest Rebirth issues. But for the most part, if you're a pretty dedicated comics reader, yeah, you can just wait for the actual number one to come out.
Yeah. Now I really like the DC Universe Rebirth number one. And then I liked everything, all of the series that involve Flash and Wally West and Batman that have kind of tied into Rebirth, because you do have this whole thing that Wally West is back. Flash and Batman both know that there's some outside force, you know, tinkering with things. And those two kind of under the surface are looking at this from a very different perspective. So I have really enjoyed those books quite a bit. And so I think Rebirth has been doing quite well. Rodrigo, I'm sorry I didn't include you in that question, but I don't think you've been reading the DC stuff, have you?
I have not.
Okay, so I wasn't intentionally shoving you aside.
Oh, that's cool.
It's not like when he has a conversation intentionally to shove me aside.
Here's a question. I recently read Death of Ultimate Spider-Man and Ultimates versus Avengers. It was okay, but Spidey's Ultimate Death, see what I did there, didn't really have the impact I was expecting. Which begs the question, what comic book death affected you the most? When Bodhi died in Lock and Key, I was unexpectedly touched.
Ooh.
Yeah, the Peter Parker death in, spoilers, Ultimate Spider-Man was probably not as big a deal to me as maybe some other people were hoping it would be. Yeah. For me, I know when Elastic Man wife died. Sue Dibney. When she died, I was like, oh man, this is really, really sad, because you get to that page in the book. Now, granted, there's a whole lot of problems with that arc, with that series, but that one page where he gets home and the fire sprinklers are going and he's holding his wife who has been burnt to death and he's crying and literally falling apart. That's a pretty impactful moment for me. So that was probably a comic book death that affected me the most. Matthew, what about you? What's a comic book death that affected you the most? Or do they?
Well, when you say,
or do you have a heart of darkness? No, I mean, like,
I'm the biggest weenie on this lot. I mean, Rodrigo and Ed are both tougher than I am.
Oh no, I cry at the drop of a hat. There's a hat just dropped.
Well,
oh,
gosh. Yeah, but
I'm it falls to the ground. Oh,
when you say most, I have to go way back. Have to go way, way back to probably before I started reading comics officially. There's an issue of House of Mystery, I believe it is, where a guy gets involved in this weird Twilight Zone-esque plot where he's a pool hall shooter guy, and he gets transported into a giant pool table and is crushed between two balls. And at the end, the guy that he tried to cheat takes the pool ball and he says, oh, there's some scuzz on this. And he wipes it on his shirt. And that's like the man's last mortal remains. That messed me up for years. I had nightmares about that story. So when you say the most, it was obviously some ridiculous thing. But comic book death is weird for me. Comic book deaths, I mean, first of all, you don't treat them seriously. I do that thing that, well, even, you know, even when they were meaningful, I never thought they were all that meaningful. I mean, the Legion of Superheroes killed Invisible Kid in the 70s. And yeah, he stayed dead. But it was Invisible Kid. I mean, even in the Legion, they treated him like the third-class guy. He was like Bouncing Boy's big brother who got to stick around because he had a cool headband. So comic book deaths are really hard to affect me. They have to be really, really gross. Or really, really, really emotionally impactful. So there are a ton that I could go through, but
I think in the spirit of the question, though, I think he's looking for emotional, like, sadness of a death. Rodrigo, do you have one of those in comics?
Sort of. I remember I basically started reading X-Men in the 90s, which makes me reverse everyone else X-Men reader, right? Because those are the X-Men that I liked. And like late 90s and like early 2000s. And there was a character named Mero, whose power was that she grew sharp bones that she took out of her body and stabbed people with.
Like Spike.
Yeah. I mean, Mero was in the comics when Spike got, because he's from the show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was what he was. He was that they're like, well, we're not actually going to do Mero, are we? Kind of stuff, which is fine. There's this arc after that first run that she was in, like actually in the X-Men, where they put her in a chamber and make her pretty. And that's actually the most impactful comic book death I've ever seen, because it killed the character for me and it killed the X-Men for me for a long time. That was the first time that I was like genuinely, as a young, relatively young reader, like disappointed in a comic. It was like actually and emotionally frustrating. And to this day, I still don't read X-Men regularly, not because I'm mad, not because I'm like, X-Men, but it did kind of like kill something inside me where I was like, I don't think I need to read X-Men comics anymore. And I kind of haven't since.
Interesting. Ashley, what comic book death affected you the most?
Well, first of all, you all can go to hell for not thinking that Peter Parker's Ultimate Spider death is impactful.
Well,
you're all wrong.
There's a reason for that. because, and I've said this a million times, when they went with that that awful arc where Dr. Doom like tilted the planet and all the water flooded New York. What was that? What was that series? Ultimate End or whatever
Ultimatum.
It was?
Ultimatum.
Ultimatum. It's the worst arc ever, and really soured me on everything coming out of the Ultimate Universe. So by the time Peter Parker finally died afterwards, I was like, whatever.
I just think him being like, oh, Aunt May, I finally saved you is like so tragic. But I think I've said this before on this podcast. I know I've said it on Geek History Lesson and probably some other podcasts on the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. When I was a teenager, my father passed away. So anytime you do dad stuff, I'm going to be a disaster. So when Tim Drake's father, who I really don't otherwise care about, bites the dust on Identity Crisis, I cry every time. And in All-Star Superman, when Pa Kent dies in issue number 6, I think it is one of the most beautiful issues in comics. I think the dichotomy of, like, what's the one thing that a Superman can't save you from is such impactful storytelling. And yeah, those are the two that always stand out to me and make me cry. And that's how I recommend them to people to read. I'm like, it'll make you cry.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on the Tim Drake's father panel, because that is just, and then Batman's just getting in there, and yeah, that's just blah, 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 blah. All right.
Come back, hat.
Yeah, come back, hat.
We have now mentioned the two good scenes from Identity Crisis.
Right there. Yeah, for real.
We don't have to talk about it.
Well, there's a pretty cool Deathstroke fight, though.
Years.
My daughter is turning 15 months old next week, and I realize I never asked the question I meant to ask 15 months ago. What was the most significant pregnancy birth in comics? Most significant?
Franklin Richards.
Yeah, probably. I would probably say yes. Or
Franklin was the first. I don't know if he was the first child born in comics, but he was the first time that an established hero and an established heroine got together. I hate the word heroine. Why did I say heroine? Two established heroes got together and had a baby. They were pregnant for whatever it was. You know, they had that time frame. It may have been 9 months. It may have been longer. That he was born.
Not 9 months, that, 10 months, 40 weeks.
Oh, for gosh sake. Don't correct me in mid-sentence. That's Steven's job. But yes, basically, we saw the whole thing. Well, not the whole thing, but we saw basically Sue get pregnant, Sue get more pregnant, Sue super pregnant, Sue has a baby. Then there's Franklin, and he's been changing ages ever since.
I'm beyond that. I'm trying to even think of other. I mean, were there other any big significant?
Mary Jane's been pregnant a couple times briefly. Yeah, Mary Jane,
Mayday Parker, for sure. Although that's an alternate reality, I would say she's a significant birth. Damian Wayne is a significant birth.
I suppose, but that's kind of like after the fact. It's like, here's your 8-year-old son, you deadbeat dad.
For me,
he was born in Son of the Demon.
For me, probably the most narratively significant birth is the birth of the narrator in Saga.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Hazel, yeah.
I
love that.
I do like the whole pregnancy thing and being a father that went on in Invincible. And And him trying to come to grips with all of that, being a father.
Yeah, talk about a comic with daddy issues.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, good question there.
And of course, don't get the blood.
Yeah. As it stands, Captain America: Civil War will likely make more money than all of the comics this year. Do you think that the comics industry is in a healthy state? Is there anything you think that could be translate to the popularity of characters in other mediums back to actual comics sold? Well,
no.
I think they said something like 10 million comics or $10 million of comics were sold this last year, right? Something like that. So that's not insignificant.
I would argue that the comic industry currently is overall as healthy as it's been in the 20th.
I would agree with you. In fact,
century.
I think they said last year 100 million comics were sold. So that was good. This year in 2014, 100 million comics were sold. In 2015, 90 million comics were sold in that entire year. But I would agree with you, Matthew. I think overall the industry is very healthy right now.
Well, someday we'll start counting digital sales.
Yeah, someday.
Right. Like they matter because they do. And some series will be saved based on their digital sales. And I think that would be an even more accurate reflection of how the market is doing. It really, as someone who's worked in retail and publishing now in comics, it really bugs me this idea that because people watch movies and TV shows, they want to go read the comics. I do understand the brand synergy up to a certain point, and there definitely are people who will walk in and say, I watch Daredevil on Netflix. What do I read now? But those people make up so few within the market. Like your average customer is somebody who's been buying comics most of their adult life, if not most of their life, and they have a pull list and they buy what they buy. And so frankly, it doesn't matter how well Captain America does because my mom has seen all of the Avengers movies and I guarantee you will never read a comic book.
Yeah. 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 My oldest son is like that too.
Part of the thing with comics,
he really likes the TV shows and the movies, really doesn't have a big interest in reading the comics.
Yeah. What are you going to say, Matthew?
There are two things with comics that I think are going to be really hard to overcome. The first is the psychotic arcane ordering process.
Yes.
Which is an unnecessary slog put together by a complete idiot. But secondly, it's the fact that comics are designed and are continuing to be sold as ongoing narratives. It's that first one is free and then you're hooked for life. And a lot of people don't have that. I mean, even if I don't want to buy comics or I don't want to buy as many comics, right now I'm in a real down phase where I'm not reading 30, 40, 50 comics a month. I'm still interested in comics. I still love going to the digital Golden Age Comic Museum and reading stuff from 1942. But I feel like there's a problem in that a lot of people are not interested. Story that you have to buy once a month, ordered 2 months ahead of time in chunks that will run between 6 months and a year in most cases. You know,
well,
it's,
and even at $2.99, if you're reading more than two books, it's not a cheap hobby either.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
And especially when we're in this day and age of binge watching TV shows, I really think that you need to release a story in one giant volume and that's it. I mean, look at the Earth One books, those graphic novels, they sell extremely well in traditional bookstores because it is a done in one story and it's not all wrapped up in, hey, here's a monthly trade. Now, going back to what you said, Ashley, a moment ago about digital comic sales, the only way we know how comics are being sold is because Diamond Comic Distributors are the ones releasing not even accurate numbers. They're just saying, here's an index. And then it takes two other sites to go through and speculate on what those actual numbers are. Within 5% is about how close those numbers actually are. On the Comixology side, the digital side, they don't even have to report any of that. And I don't think that there is even an easy way to halfway speculate what those comics are unless you went into Amazon, which is you can also buy those digital comics through Amazon, to go in there and see where that individual issue ranks among all the other comics sold that they have in their inventory. That would be the only way to do it. But I really wish we could get some numbers on what digital sales are. But you think that that would save a lot of comics?
It could.
Yeah.
I think it could because I think too that because the price point is lower and because a lot of people like to have their comics on their devices, I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah. The books that are aimed at non-traditional markets, at younger readers, at people who aren't the normal, well, I don't want to say normal, people who aren't part of that mainstream, I go in the store, I get my previews, I order what's coming out 2 months from now. These are readers who I feel are underserved. And I feel like that Ashley's right. They're in that digital reading populace, but no one's counting them because the industry is locked into that. We sell six issues, then made. You know, it's something where we've always done it like this has become literally the bellwether of an entire industry.
Well, I think
it's nuts.
I think there's a bigger shakeup coming as far as how comics are marketed and sold. And I think that will happen. Not right now, obviously, because we're hitting the, 50 million variants. But I think within the next 2 years, we're going to hit a point where the marketing of these comics is going to be really looked at, and we will probably see a bigger emphasis put on digital sales than on traditional sales, which only reason why they put as much emphasis on the print sales, the physical sales, is to placate the brick and mortar stores. But we'll see what happens. What is the most valuable? What is the most valuable individual comics comics run in your collection, be it monetarily or sentimentally? I don't know what my most expensive comic is. I mean, I have some ideas. I have some Flash comics that are up into the hundreds of dollars for individual issues. But that also goes into the second part of the question. What book did you put the most effort into getting would be my Flash run, because I'm back into the early 70s, late 60s run of the Flash right now as far as collecting goes. And it takes a lot of money to get those issues, but I also have a complete run of the Flash from like 1975 forward at this point. I could look and, I mean, I could really look and find out that as far as the monetary price, but if what book did I put the most in, effort into getting would be probably, what is it, Flash 95, the first appearance of Impulse, because that was the one that sold out right away, and I it took me about 5 years to finally track that thing down. So, yeah. Matthew, what about you?
Monetarily, I'm pretty sure it's Marvel Boy number one from 1954. Last time I checked, mine's about a 7.5, which would run into four digits. As far as a most valuable run, I have almost, I don't have an Adventure 247, but I have an almost complete run of the Legion of Superheroes through about 1995, 97, maybe. There are some notable gaps, but I don't have the first appearance. I don't have the Supergirl issue, but I have most of the early Legion. The book that I put the most effort into getting is Hulk number 161. And the biggest problem with there is whenever you ask someone if they have a Hulk 161, they assume you want Hulk 181. But I looked for that thing for years. And finally, the first Christmas that I spent with my soon-to-be wife, she bought me a copy of Hulk 161.
Aww.
And I said, yep, I'm going to marry that girl.
Wait, I thought you guys were already married like 4 days after you met.
No, they were engaged
4 days after. Oh, okay. All right.
It took us a couple of months to get married. We didn't get married until next April 1st.
Ah, I see. Ashley, do you have, what is your most valuable comic, sentimentally or monetarily?
Here's the thing you have to know about me. Give me something that's worth a lot of money, there's like a 99% chance that I'll sell it and buy something that I want more that's kind of worthless.
Yeah.
So that's just the thing about me. I'm also a trade waiter, and I have been most of my life, because when I was a kid, I couldn't afford to buy comics every week. So I don't have a ton of floppies. I also refuse to allow myself more than a single long box of floppies. For moving purposes.
Oh my God. You poor child. How can
you? So I used to be collecting the Chuck Dixon Robin run from the 90s, which is basically worthless because it's my favorite thing of all time. But then DC started printing the trades, so I stopped. Because that's way easier, and it doesn't smell kind of funny because I got it out of a box from someone's garage. Like, as far as monetary value, I don't think I have any comics that are like really worth anything, to be completely honest, like money wise. I have the miniseries in floppies where Tim becomes Robin, and where he like puts on Dick's Robin suit for the first time. That means a lot to me for sentimental reasons. Everything else I have is like, this is just a trade. It's a much nicer collection.
Oh, no, I understand that. I need to do that. I've got too many comics. Rodrigo, what about you? Do you have something that falls into one of these categories?
I think if we're talking about like individual issues, probably the most monetarily valuable thing I have is that like first or I want to say maybe second issue of Gen 13, the one where we find out Rainmaker is a lesbian.
Oh yeah.
That's number two.
Yeah.
So still Adam Hughes drawing that.
I think so.
No, it's Jason Campbell.
Yeah. So that's probably worth all of like $3.
$18 in good condition.
Ah, well, there you go. So probably it's probably worth six. Yep. So it's probably worth about $9. there's that. Otherwise, I have a pretty hefty like hardback of a Black Sad, which I think it's just like an expensive like giant hardback full color book, right? As far as emotional attachment, not really anything in particular, like, or like working hard to get anything, because I moved around a lot and I was always bad about keeping up with things. So even as a little baby child starting to get into comics, I knew that I was never going to be able to spend the time and money to get a complete run of anything. I sort of ended up with a near complete run of Marvel or like X-Men's like Fleer Ultra cards from like 1996, I want to say, but I still don't have like all the wacky like variants. It's just, you know, I have all the straight run, but I don't have like the Halloween costume ones or like the Age of Apocalypse ones or whatever, you know, like the super rare ones. So, I mean, and I'm fine with it. It's just kind of how it is. So not really.
Yeah. Boom Studios announced a wrestling WWE series. Is that what it is, Matthew? Or is it WWF? Do you know?
WWE.
Okay. Another question is, are there any wrestlers that you'd be intrigued to read a comic about?
Much back in the 90s. I really enjoyed China's comics back in the 90s. The late China was one of my favorites. I think if you broke it down, probably Ric Flair.
Interesting.
Rock and roll comics where they go back and they tell actual wacky stories of Ric Flair's life, because that man is a lunatic,
yeah,
by the way. But he's a lunatic in all the best ways. And you can tell the story about how he broke his back, but in order to maintain kayfabe, he wrestled a whole match with a broken back so no one would know that he, the villain, had been riding with the hero. My stars, it could be the end of humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really, you guys remember when we did like Avengers Forever back in the day? So that's a comic that has like a lot of like deep history and just takes all the nonsense from the Marvel universe and either tries to make sense of it or just like really celebrates it, plus adds a whole other layer of nonsense on top of it. I want to see something like that for wrestling, something where there's this universe that exists where you can have a guy like the Undertaker, like a straight up undead monster,
right?
And also a guy like CM Punk, who is a guy who doesn't drink like that. Right. That's like, you know, he's got a lot more going on than that. But for a long time, that was kind of like his thing. And it's just like a place where all of these nonsense guys, where you have, you know, Hulk Hogan and like a guy who's an actual literal vampire, you know, like all kind of in the same place, and like an explanation for where all the half robots and like retired school teachers and like how this all comes to be like a thing, and like how these guys all hang out together.
Crisis on Infinite Mats, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And it's like, it's just like a picture of like McMahon holding like the earth, like haha, like doing his like crazy laugh.
All right, everybody. I think that's where we're going to wrap it up this week. What did we learn this week? Well, the internet sucks, as does Skype. Don't ever diss the death of Peter Parker in the Ultimate Spider-Man universe. Ashley will cut you bad. And sometimes it's okay to have a hint that a Legion of Superheroes series is coming, I think.
Mon-El.
All right, everybody. That wraps it up for this installment of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. If you found some value in this episode, please consider becoming one of our patrons at patreon.com/majorspoilers. You can contribute as little or as much as you want. The higher you go, the more rewards that you get. And you can find out more at patreon.com/majorspoilers. We thank everyone for their support. And we'll be back next week, because we know that you love comics, and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel. I'm gonna rearrange your face if you continue to debate whether Logan's claws could pierce Steve Rogers' shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. Spider-Man's a clone. Stop spending all our cash on back issues of The Flash, or I swear to God you're gonna spend your twilight years alone.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.